Well, thank you very much, Pam, for introducing me, and thank you everyone for having me. I'm going to be speaking about language training for the workplace in a global perspective. As Pam has just mentioned, I spent most of this year building a research center devoted to bilingual education in the Middle East, which is really in many ways built upon the model of the IMEP Research Center. And one thing that always strikes me when I, you know, look at the IMEP and discourses, particularly the view of the IMEP from outside the IMEP in Australia and overseas, that how different those views are. In Australia, I have the sense that, particularly in the media, we often get the sense the IMEP is not particularly appreciated. We even can get the sense that the IMEP is a crisis. I mean, I thought it was very, very heartening how Laurie reiterated the commitment of the current government to the IMEP and to providing language and settlement support to new migrants. At the same time, I think we all, you know, many of you might have been disappointed that there was no large celebration of the 60th anniversary, for instance. At the same time, we often hear expectations about how we are not delivering on employment outcomes and those kinds of things. And in the wider world, outside Australia, the IMEP is still regarded as the best practice language and settlement model internationally, and that's something that we often lose sight of here. So what I want to be talking about, how come that we often have this very negative view almost of the IMEP, and what I want to be arguing is that probably we are a bit overburdening the IMEP with expectations. One quote that I've got here, and this is from before the election, so it was when the Honourable Burke was still in opposition, is this: yes, the IMEP should provide seamless transition from the airport to the workplace, sort of. And, well, we're not very good at doing that. I think we sort of need to acknowledge, you know, the IMEP hasn't really been very good in providing a seamless transition from the airport to the workplace. But is that really what we should be doing? So that's what I want to be asking today. And I want to say, I think partly this comes from the fact that we maybe have the wrong assumptions about what language learning is and how it relates to particularly finding employment, how it relates to settlement. So maybe it's a good time to step back a bit and look at those assumptions that underpin our understanding about the relationship between language learning and settlement in a new country, and particularly finding employment. I always find cartoons very instructive, so what I'm trying to do is very similar to what this cartoon tries to do. So we have the little girl saying, "Well, look here, a big yellow butterfly." It's unusual to see one this time of the year, unless, of course, he flew up from Brazil. I bet that's it. They do that sometimes, you know. They fly up all the way from Brazil. This is not a butterfly. It's a potato chip. Well, I'll be, so it is. I wonder how a potato chip got up all the way here from Brazil. So, obviously, someone's asking the wrong question. It is possible to ask the wrong questions and have the wrong expectations if you have the wrong assumptions. Once you have the assumption that this thing, you know, came up all the way from Brazil, then obviously you're asking, how did it get here? So our assumptions really shape the questions we ask. And so I'm saying maybe we're asking some of the wrong questions based on questionable assumptions. The four assumptions I want to specifically look at and then sort of bring them in the context of global research on these three assumptions is A, that there is such a thing as workplace language, and also a related assumption that it's different from language for settlement. I want to be looking at the assumption that language learning in the real world is really, that's where we should be, that the real world is sort of superior to what we are doing in the classroom. And I want to look at the assumption that limited proficiency in English is the main barrier to finding adequate employment faced by migrants. And I want to look at the assumption that employment is the key indicator of social inclusion. Basically, employment equals social inclusion. So let me start with the first one. Assumption that there is such a thing as workplace language, and we can kind of divvy up what we teach. So in this section today, I'm teaching workplace language, and then I move on to the next classroom where I'm teaching language for settlement. Well, what actually is that language, that workplace language? Let me just maybe tell you a little story of my own employment trajectory and how language figured in that. So currently I'm a university professor, and language figures pretty strongly in what I'm doing. At the end of the day, the university pays me for my language and communication skills. I'm talking right now, so that's part of my work. I write emails, I publish research, I sit in meetings. So pretty much everything I'm doing is language and communication related. That's what I'm being paid for. I'm doing language work at the end of the day. And the same is presumably true of pretty much everyone in this room. In an earlier incarnation in my life, while I was studying for my undergraduate degree in Britain, I was working as what was then called a barmaid. And their language figures quite differently. Language was a bit of an access criterion because the pub owner who hired me into the position had a thing about German accents and how, you know, German are heavy drinkers, so he kind of felt a German accent might do something for his business. But at the end of the day, what I did in the job was, you know, draft beer, serve drinks, wash glasses, and stack glasses. There wasn't really anything language related. At the same time, language had an important outcome on my actual income because I earned £2.50 or something, minimum wage, but I could get tips if I was charming. So obviously, being charming involves language, and so the better I talk, the better for my income. So we see a different relationship between language and the workplace or my employment, my income in that particular position. Another job I worked also as a student was as at a checkout counter in a supermarket, check. Their language had no role whatsoever because you're not at all encouraged to interact with clients because you are in a rush. And in many ways, putting on a grim face and not encouraging interactions helps you deal with your work much more efficiently. And it's really all about speed and getting things across the scanner. And anything that involves interactions is not actually handled by the checkout operator because, you know, even if someone wants to return, a little banana or something, you need to refer to your supervisor. So language plays no role in that particular workplace. I also worked in a tube factory for a while, and what I was paid for there was actually to stack tubes and kind of quality check tubes. There, even if I had wanted to speak to anyone, certainly I wasn't paid for talking, but even if I had wanted to speak to my colleagues, it was impossible because of the noise on the factory floor. So you have very, very high levels of noise on the production floor. Language is impossible. And many people have done research in production floor work actually find that not only is it impossible, there may even be penalties on speaking to your co-workers simply because we want to sort of speed up the production line. So language prohibited, basically. Finally, the last story of my work life is I grew up on a small farm in southern Germany, and so kind of was engaged in farm work from a very early age. And I think there in farming you even have a different ethos about language. The ethos is that work and language are something that's different. You often have the stereotype of rural people as being very silent people, actually valuing silence. What all these little anecdotes tell us is that language plays very, very different roles in the great diversity of workplaces that are out there. And it's kind of hard to predict what the language needs, or the language needs of a particular workplace really depend on the workplace, on the industry, and on the occupation. And so in a sense need to be tailored to those. If you sort of want to get this in a more systematic way and you read French, then there's a fantastic book that came out last year by a French sociolinguist, Language at Work from Manufacturing to Call Centers, which also speaks about the fact how not only are the language needs of different workplaces different, but it has also changed as societies like ours have lost much of production work and moved on to more service and knowledge-oriented economy. So historically, language has really gained its importance, and I think that's one of the key challenges that migrants are facing today, that they are moving more and more into workplaces where language and communication are centrally important. So if you look at what, you know, back in the days after the Second World War, when migrants from non-English-speaking countries first started to arrive, that was really the time of production work, of labor. And I like this plaque comes from the Mundaring Weir in Western Australia. And why, why I've taken a picture is that it says more than 70 refugees arriving in Australia after World War II were contracted to work on raising the wall and clearing the land for the enlarged reservoir. The contract was part of their migration requirements. The men ranged from professors to laborers, and for most was their first experience of life in Australia. And I've always felt, look, had I come 50 years earlier, I might have ended up, built the Mundaring Weir. Not that it was only men. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, in a sense, production work, the sectors that we have lost pretty much over the past decades, are those that make it easier for migrants in terms of language requirements. At the same time, we also have as a country a history of kind of indiscriminately slotting migrants into certain work. And the studies with the professionals who came after the Second World War and worked off their migration requirements as laborers show that they never regained. They were very, very unlikely to regain their former professional positions. And I mean, so if you were a professor and worked for a year on the Mundaring Weir and then learn English, it's kind of hard to get back into your previous work. So I hope that I've shown that this assumption that there is such a thing as a workplace language really needs to be questioned quite carefully. So I'd like to move on to the second assumption that I want to look at, and that is that language learning in the real world, out in the workplace, is somehow better than what we do in the classroom. Because in the classroom, we are all academics, and teachers are also sort of not real people, in a way the people out of the classroom are real. So the language learning that you learn in the workplace is the language that you need in the world. That you need in the workplace. Let me first of all show you a little video to kind of question that assumption. This video, just to contextualize it a bit, is from the website Australians at Work, and shows the employment history, or a little interview with Hien Tran, migrant from Vietnam, and it looks at her workplace. Again, I think it brings home the point that workplaces you know, the great diversity of workplaces, but it also questions the point, this woman doesn't learn anything in her work because she's not talking to anyone. So let me just show this to you. I think it's really quite moving, if I get it.
It is currently estimated that over 300,000 Australians are trapped in a hidden world of exploitation known as outwork.
Thì tôi rất là shock bởi vì tôi không nghĩ rằng mình cái người may ở nhà bị bóc lột đến như vậy. Khi tôi thấy rằng mình được trả lương không có được công bằng như vậy mà tôi vẫn phải làm công việc làm người may ở nhà. Hơn nữa khi tôi đi kiếm việc khác thì tôi cũng không có kiếm được việc vào cái lúc mà tôi muốn. Mà ở trong những hãng may thì họ cũng đâu có muốn tuyển những người may ở trong hãng đâu. Họ muốn những người may ở nhà làm việc đó cho họ để có lời hơn. If I didn't continue to work as an art worker, my family couldn't survive.
Throughout the 1990s, Hien, like many other art workers, continued her attempts to improve her language skills while dealing with the constant demands of work.
At daytime, we go to English class, and nighttime, we sew at home and stay up late. Last night and in the morning, I went to English class. I have one English teacher in the class, but I saw two or three teachers at the same time because my eye flew and I couldn't see her clearly.
I think it's a quite powerful evidence of A, that in the workplace you do not necessarily learn English because you may be in a very isolated workplace, and second, that work is not necessarily conducive to your language learning. And I'm sure you all, those of you who are teaching in the classroom, have similar experiences and stories to tell. I've heard, you know, this story in so many variations from pretty much any teacher in the IMEP I've ever spoken to. In terms of research findings around the assumption that language learning in the real world is better than language learning in the classroom, that's not what's borne out. Naturalistic acquisition usually has very poor language learning outcomes, as we know from large European studies that looked at migrants who tried to acquire various European languages in untutored contexts. Those who have any background in applied linguistics know the classic study by Schumann with Alberto, a Mexican migrant in the US, of course familiar with the term fossilization, which basically says if you are not made to notice the structures of a new language, you just fossilize at a particular level and you stop progressing. So you really need to be shown what's there. You need to be demonstrated the features of a language. Another research finding is that, and that's again from the US, Twice Dwyer worked with Polish migrants coming to the US. What she showed was that entering the workforce does not in itself constitute an opportunity to learn English. Obviously, it doesn't if you are an out worker, but it doesn't in many production contexts either, where you are on the factory floor and there is no time to speak English, engage in interactions. A range of research shows that lack of proficiency in English locks migrants into low-skilled manual short-term work. So, like Vilena's works with Mexican migrants in the US, and she particularly focused on chicken factory farm workers and very precarious work, and again, only a chance to get out of it for migrants who have English. The other important factor there was visa categories. Can also low proficiency in English or whatever the language of a particular country is, can also lock migrants into ethnic workplaces, as Janet has. Where are you actually? There you are. Has shown in a paper relative to Australian and New Zealand workplaces in 1993. It can also lock migrants into the shadow economy, as Le Poton and Fichte have shown, and also Ehrenreich Hochschild for domestic workers in the US. Ehrenreich Hochschild look at domestic migrants and domestic work in the US. Le Poton and Fichte look at sex workers in Switzerland, something that migrant women, a form of exploitation that migrant women with low German or French skills are particularly prone to exploitation. And finally, limited English proficiency upon entering the workforce is likely to further jeopardize social inclusion, as Goldstein has shown. Goldstein worked with Portuguese women working in a Portuguese ethnic workplace in Toronto, and these women tried to get into those workplaces because they didn't have English, so they were, in a sense, locked into the ethnic workplace. They didn't need English in their work, so that was fine in a sense. However, all of them reported all kinds of humiliating experiences outside the workplace. They had a hard time going to the dentist, they had a hard time engaging in their children's schooling, and so on and so forth. And the fact that there was no necessity around that workplace to improve their English, and that the workplace didn't really provide a chance to learn English either, although that particular workplace was part of the Canadian sort of equivalent of the IMEP, had a workplace training scheme. It was during the break hour, and during that one break hour, the women were, you know, just as tired as anyone else and needed their work just as anyone else. So really, it wasn't going very far. And limited proficiency can also reinforce existing gender inequality, as Schmalzbauer shows in a recent study of rural migrants coming to Montana in the US, where it is particularly the women who find it very hard to get out of the house eventually and are very, very isolated. So let me move on to the third assumption. Limited proficiency in English is the main barrier to adequate employment faced by migrants. There is no doubt that limited English is a central barrier. It is a key barrier, as I've just shown. I mean, I think it's so important. But at the same time, having good English for a migrant does not necessarily mean that they achieve their desired social inclusion and workplace outcomes. And so I think that's also something that we need to be looking at. And this is particularly crucial relative to skilled migrants in the skilled visa class who actually cannot access the IMEP. The best evidence that there are barriers other than English proficiency comes from a recent study conducted by colleagues at the IMU, where the researchers sent out fake CVs to a number of workplaces, and the only thing in which the CVs differed was actually in the ethnic name of the applicant. The CVs made it clear that the applicants had had their secondary schooling in Australia, so there really couldn't be any doubt about their English. But they sent out CVs with Chinese names, Indigenous names, Italian names, and Anglo names. And they found that the callback rates for the Chinese names in particular was a quarter of those of the Anglo names. And there was just the stark discrepancy between the response rate that the Anglo named candidates, or the fake Anglo names, got to their CVs and the Chinese and Indigenous names in particular. The only encouraging, if you will, where one ethnic name was more advantageous even than an Anglo name was in applications for barista in Melbourne. An Italian name is better than I know that. So outside that segment, I'm afraid. Similar findings from another study in Western Australia, where the researchers from which university is out in WA? Murdoch, that's right, Murdoch, from Murdoch University, were looking at selected refugee communities in Australia, and they were looking at a group, and they were trying to find a who is working below their qualification level and who is unemployed. And the key finding really was that as far as the European refugees from Bosnia were concerned, they really were less, they were also likely to be underemployed or unemployed, but they were less likely to be underemployed and unemployed than refugee groups from Africa and the Middle East, for some of whom you have, you know, immense unemployment rates. This is basically the same finding in a different table. So what these researchers, how they find up their, how they sum up their findings is they say the current allocation of certain ethnic groups and immigrant categories in certain industries and types of jobs in the secondary labour market does not necessarily reflect their specific skills or levels of human capital, but rather reflects on structural marginalisation and disadvantage. And so obviously language is only one of many barriers, and I think we also have an obligation as a society to work on those structural barriers and not to overburden the IMEP with something over which it has no control. Finally, the last assumption I want to look at is that employment equals social inclusion. So as soon as you have employment, you are there, basically, and that's your trajectory to settlement. One of the most important books, most important Australian books I read last year was published by the Lawrence Society, Living Low Paid, The Dark Side of Prosperous Australia by Helen Masterman Smith and Barbara Pocock. And if you haven't seen that particular book, I think it's something that I'd encourage everyone to read, because to sort of see that there is a world outside that as a professional you really are not very aware of. They were looking at childcare workers, hospitality workers, and the cleaning industry, where the low paid are concentrated. And they found that low pay was endemic in those industries. So it's part of the way those industries work. And in terms of the consequences for the people they interviewed, low pay is detrimental to individual well-being. There are shocking stories of people deferring, having a tooth pulled out because they can't afford dental treatment, and you know, in Sydney. And working. And it threatens family life, particularly the well-being of children. One of their key findings was that people in those industries were not only money poor, they were also time poor, particularly the hospitality workers who work in the luxury hotels in the city but cannot afford to live anywhere near the city. So they are commuting for a very, very long time. And so in addition to their terrible shift hours, they also have long commutes, and so there just is no time left for their children, apart from the fact that the children don't get to go on outings the same way other children do. And ultimately they're saying low pay undermines the social fabric. If people don't have time to, you know, look after themselves and their families, obviously they're not going to go out and support community endeavors. The researchers say the solution to prosperity built on low pay and inequality that they are finding in, you know, this this nation of ours is the solutions are a living wage and a social wage. By living wage is obviously minimum wage. A social wage, what they mean is services such as public transport, which make life easier for the low paid, but pretty much everyone else, I suppose. And what is interesting, although most of the low paid in their study are migrants, they have no recommendations that these people should improve their English. What they're really saying is these conditions affect anyone in those industries. So we need to reform those industries if we want to get beyond the social exclusion of those people who are working. So employment in those low-paid industries is not necessarily a stepping stone to something bigger and better. Many of the low-paid are locked into those industries and are locked into low pay. So I hope to have made an argument that we should be not necessarily completely discarding these assumptions, but certainly questioning them. And I think if we discard these false assumptions, that will allow us to do things, to do two things. On the one hand, I think it will allow us to really celebrate the achievements of the IMEP. We have done that at other times in our nation's history. I'm quoting from the 50th anniversary conference when the Honorable Philip Ruddock said the Adult Migrant English Program remains one of the greatest human success stories in this nation's history. The IMEP is one of the most important and effective language and settlement services, not only in Australia, but anywhere in the world. I think that is true. We have, as a nation, brought so many people into the fold, if you will. The IMEP is widely recognized. I just brought in another celebratory quote from a Scottish scoping study on how to integrate migrants, where they say exactly the same thing. Australia has built over the past 30 years one of the most admired, carefully thought out migrant ESOL schemes in the world. I think that remains true. At the same time, I, of course, do not want to suggest that, you know, everything is rosy and good in the IMEP, and we always have to strive to improve what it is that we are doing. But I think maybe we need to also think about reframing the challenges, in what is it where we need to be good. So we cannot really take the migrants from the airport into the workplace. The IMEP cannot do that, and no one can do that. But what we can do and where the real challenges are, in my opinion, are around nation building. That's where we are the success story, around civic engagement, around broad social inclusion, of which employment, of course, is a key aspect. Challenges are also around teacher and learner autonomy. We know that teachers teach better if they are given substantial autonomy and if they have the professionalism. We know that learners learn better if they have autonomy, and the case approach that Laurie mentioned earlier is obviously a fantastic step in that direction. I think we also need to be guided by the aspirations of our students, the future of our society, rather than visa categories. I think a key challenge in integration is around the skilled migrants, which currently have no place in the IMEP whatsoever. Because they, you know, are seen as having sufficient English, but not sufficient English, I have to add, to achieve their goals and to work at the kind of level at which we bring them in. And I think, in a sense, as a society, we are letting them down. If, you know, if you bring someone in on their skill level and then you have them drive taxis around Sydney. So rather than being concentrated on where someone comes from and their past, we really need to look towards the future of the migrants, the IMEP, and ultimately the future of Australia. And then I've got all these little dot points about how to reframe the challenges, and I think these little dot points are really something that hopefully will come out of our discussions today and out of the many presentations that you will hear out of the SPRP project, which investigated migrants' own perspectives on their language and learning and settlement over a period of 1 year, and when you'll hear all these presentations later today and tomorrow. So thank you very much for your attention.